cases of Mezikin, you learn about Odom HaMazik, you learn about Chovel B'Chaveiro. How much does this type of thing come up in terms of how Beis Din adjudicates Dinei Torah that come in front of us? So the truth is that there are aspects of Hilchos Nezikin that may come up even if the specific case that's brought in front of the Beis Din is not necessarily a classical Nezikin type of dispute. You could have a contractual dispute, for example, because somebody didn't honor their obligations under a shtar. You could have a dispute between an employer and an employee where there is a claim that an employer didn't pay proper compensation to the employee, where in the course of those types of Dinei Torah, there'll be claims that border on Hilchos Nezikin, for example, that sufficient notice wasn't given to an employee to enable the employee to find another job, and therefore that caused the employee to lose money, and maybe that is a question of whether that is Mazik Mamon Shel Chaveiro, whether it constitutes a grum or constitutes garmi. So very often you have these types of questions, even in a contractual dispute, that somebody didn't do something and it caused the person a loss, and there's a claim for consequential damages. A person says, I want you to pay my attorney's fees, and the Beis Din has to determine whether maybe even if other claims are granted, that this type of claim is not going to be granted because it's in the realm of grumma. So those types of considerations, is something grum, is it garmi, is it a direct Adam HaMazik, that comes up even in types of cases where the underlying dispute is not necessarily where Reuven punched the Shimon, where it's a type of a classical Nezikin case, or where Reuven's animal harmed the Shimon's animal or something of that sort. But I wanted to focus a little bit more on the classical Nezikin cases where there's actual physical harm that takes place, or there is a more direct harm that takes place in terms of Mazik Mamon Shel Chaveiro, where it's a direct damage as opposed to, say, just a contractual dispute. So there are three limiting factors as to why classical Nezikin cases might not be as often adjudicated in Beis Din as your standard partnership disputes or contractual disputes or landlord-tenant disputes or employer-employee disputes and so forth. One factor is insurance, is the fact that when it comes to physical types of damages, very often people are covered nowadays by insurance policies. Rabbi Bleich, for example, wrote many years ago in one of his Sfarim Contemporary Halachic Problems. This is, I think, widely accepted and widely acknowledged by most poskim, but he may have been the first person to write about it. I was once discussing it with him, and he was very confident that he was the first person who put this in print. So I will take his word for it, since he reads everything that's in print anyway. So he said that since insurance companies are not Jewish, let's say that Reuven causes a damage to Shimon through his car, for example, that Reuven's car collides with Shimon's car and it causes damage. So Shimon is generally not going to go after collect the damages from Reuven. Shimon is going to collect the damages from Reuven's insurance company. Or, for example, you have a case where somebody accidentally causes damage to an individual who's visiting their house, that they accidentally whack them, let's say their child accidentally whacks the other somebody else's child with a baseball bat, and as a result they're playing baseball and the baseball bat, Reuven's son whacks Shimon's son with a baseball bat accidentally, and the homeowner's insurance is going to cover any damages that may have occurred under those circumstances, that it's all included within the liability that takes place on the premises. So Shimon's family is not going to go after, not going to collect from Reuven per se, they'll collect from Reuven's insurance carriers. That's another example. Or you have a doctor that commits medical malpractice. So there's a very lengthy sugya that discusses when is it that under halacha a doctor who causes damage is liable for having to compensate for the damage that was caused. Like, for example, a doctor is an OBGYN and is in charge of delivering a baby, and the doctor makes a miscalculation. Really, this baby should have been delivered to a cesarean section because it was a complicated birth and the child was very big and the opening was very narrow, and the doctor instead decides that he's going to do, or she's going to do, a natural birth, and as a result the baby is very damaged. This is a case that was discussed by Bill Yashiv of Shach. It's printed in the Yeshurun Journal. They speak about this case, but there are many similar type cases. So the family that suffered the damage, the family that had the deformed baby, the baby that now is going to be, say, incapacitated for life because the doctor made a bad decision, so is that family going to go after the doctor according to halacha to collect from the doctor directly? Or are they going to go after the insurance carrier? If they would go after the doctor directly, we have a general principle. There are three toseptas that talk about a doctor's liability. They all say different things. You're probably familiar. One tosepta says that if a doctor is licensed, meaning that the doctor has received a shus bezdin. Nowadays, I work for a bezdin. We don't license any doctors. But it used to be that the batei din would license the doctors. Now we rely upon the medical licensing authorities. The medical schools and the medical establishment. So if they license the doctor, that the doctor can practice, that's considered, say, the post can be equivalent of Rishus Bezdin. So one tosefta says, if it's Rishus Bezdin, even though we have a general principle of Adam Mu'ad the Olam, if somebody causes damage, they physically hurt somebody else, then that, or even they physically hurt somebody else's property, they're the individual who caused the damage. So we say Adam Mu'ad the Olam. But if the doctor is licensed, so as a tikkun ha'olam, we say that the doctor is pata if it was b'shogeg, if it was b'mezid. The doctor can't get away with b'mezid. The doctor deliberately harms a patient, so then they're still going to be chayev. Then there's another tosefta that says that if a doctor kills somebody b'shogeg, the chayev goes. They say, well, why should the doctor be chayev goes? We say that a doctor gets a special dispensation that they're off the hook. So there are different terutzim that are given. Maybe it depends on whether the doctor was really practicing medicine or whether the doctor made such a serious mistake, they just gave the wrong medicine altogether. Suppose they gave the right medicine, but they couldn't figure out the right dosage. Okay, that's a judgment error. They're not going to go into Chagolos for that if the person dies. But if they amputate, say, the wrong limb, or they prescribe the wrong medicine altogether, so that's not considered to be practicing medicine altogether. So then such a case, that's considered to be close to the Pshia. So then the doctor would be Chayev Golos. And another Tosefta says the doctor is part of B'dinei Adam, Chayev B'dinei Shemayim. So the post can wrestle with that. They say, well, if the doctor really was using their best judgment, so maybe the doctor would even be part of B'dinei Shemayim. If the case would come in front of Bezdin would have to make these determinations. Did the doctor commit gross negligence? In which case, according to halacha, even if the doctor was licensed, maybe the doctor would be chayev. Was it just regular negligence? In which case, maybe it would be chayev b'dei shemayim, potter b'dei adam. Or was it that the doctor just made a mistake, used his best judgment according to his training? No other doctor would have necessarily done a better job. In which case, we would say that even though normally adam u'al yolam, the doctor is going to be off the hook. Well, the doctor, the Tashbetz and the Chida, and many of Cheskabamsky, everybody wrestles with how to reconcile these different toseftas. That probably is a reasonably accurate breakdown of how we would deal with these things, la halacha. But lemaisa, it's very interesting in theory as to how a bezdin would paskin with respect to medical malpractice. But at the end of the day, everybody knows that in a medical malpractice case, the family of Shimon that was harmed by the OBGYN doctor not delivering the baby responsibly, maybe it was very negligent in this case, maybe it was partially negligent, whatever it was, they're not going to follow the halakhic standards. They're just going to go after the insurance company. The insurance company, generally speaking, the poskim all assume the insurance company is not going to be a Jewish insurance company. Even the Israeli poskim, apparently the doctors, at least at the time in which these tshuvas were circulated, maybe 20 years ago or so, most of the doctors were covered by some insurance company that was located in London, and it was understood that they weren't a Jewish insurance company. So you could work with the assumption that the insurance company is not interested in adjudicating the case in Bezdin. The insurance company is only going to go in court And courts, they're going to go to court. The court is going to decide according to the general secular principles of medical liability. I could go even further. Even if the insurance company would be prepared to go to Beis Din, the policy that the insurance company commits itself to says that they're going to provide for insurance, they're going to provide for compensation and a payment according to certain standards that are not halakhic standards. It's like a hischaivus. A doctor obtains the insurance policy, so it's like they're agreeing to a certain hischaivus that they're going to pay, even if the halakha wouldn't mandate that payment would be made, but it is a part of what enables people who have suffered terrible injury to be made whole. So the insurance steps in and they say, we're prepared. If we find that there's a certain measure of a negligence that took place, so we're prepared to pay a very substantial premium in terms of the medical costs, in terms of the pain and the suffering, in terms of the inconvenience and the consequential damages, and the fact that the person's never going to be the same again for life, and the emotional distress that was suffered, all kinds of different categories that may or may not correspond with what the halakha would have provided. So when you have these types of situations where it's going to ultimately be paid by the insurance company, and as a result, the case is brought really effectively against the insurance company. So at the end of the day, it's not really a Beis Din deliberation that's going to determine how much money is going to have to be paid, because usually these cases will be adjudicated in secular court. Is that permissible? I have to tell you, it's very interesting. If you look at your caption of a typical civil court case, let's say that Shimon was harmed by Reuven, Shimon's child was harmed by Reuven's child, and so forth. And Shimon brought Reuven, and Shimon was going against Reuven's insurance company. Let's say, what is the name of an insurance company? Allstate? Let's say Allstate. So the caption of the case doesn't say Shimon versus Allstate. The caption of the case in secular court says Shimon versus Reuven. So isn't that an Issur HaKos? That's what Rabbi Blake writes about. So Rabbi Blake says it's not an Issur HaKos, even though, meaning there's a prohibition of going to HaKos. That's this week's parasha, right? Lifnehem below Lifnehakum. You're supposed to go in front of the Jewish law judges and not in front of the secular law judges. One Jew brings another Jew to secular court. That's a violation of this Issur HaKos. It's a violation of the prohibition in the Torah. Rashi says it's like you're blaspheming God. That you're indicating that the Torah system that God gave us is not good enough, that we have to go then utilize the secular court system. The Rambam says it's like you're Meir Miyad, Neged Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, you're lifting up your arm in rebellion against the Torah that was given to us by Moshe Rabbeinu. It's considered to be a pretty serious Avera. So why is it not an Avera when Shimon takes Reuven to secular court? The caption of the case says Shimon versus Reuven. So Rabbi Black explains, the caption of the case is not binding upon us halakhically. That's not a halakhic construct, what the caption of the case is. What we care about halakhically is whether we really think that Shimon is taking Reuven to secular court. And he's not. Shimon is really taking Reuven's insurance company to secular court. Even if the caption in the court has to say that it's versus Reuven, he's really taking the insurance company. The insurance company is a non-Jewish entity that would not agree to go to Beis Din, we assume. And therefore, it's perfectly permissible to take the insurance company to secular court. And then the secular court will decide, according to the hischaivus of the insurance company, that they agreed to pay damages, even in cases where it would not be required according to halacha. Theoretically, a Beis Din could handle the case, I suppose, if the insurance company said, we agree that we're going to go to Beis Din. But in such a case, Beis Din, as I said, would presumably have to decide the case according to whatever the hischaivus was, which wouldn't be according to halakhic standards anyway. So then the Beis Din would just have to research what's the hischaivus that the insurance company would typically agree to pay. And then the Beis Din would decide according to those standards. But what if Shimon says, Reuven is the doctor. So what if Reuven says that I don't want you to go after my insurance company? I don't want you to go after my insurance company at all, because my insurance premiums will be raised. And I'm a rich guy. And if the Beis Din is going to be mechayev me to pay a lot of money, so I'll pay out of my own pocket, but I don't want my insurance company to be involved. But I would rather that the case be brought to Besdin. In most cases, the doctors are happy that if there is a real case of liability, it should be brought against the insurance company. So even if their premiums go up, they're not going to lose any money. But let's say that the doctor in this case is worried about his reputation, and he just doesn't want it in all the newspapers. He doesn't want it in the official records. He doesn't want it to be available for somebody who does a search of court decisions. The doctor says, I would rather this be adjudicated in Besdin, even though I won't have. My insurance company is not going to agree to go to Besdin, and I won't have the benefit of the insurance. But I'll just take my chances. And the doctor might also have another incentive, since the doctor knows that the standard of proof, according to halacha, is a much more strict standard of proof in terms of what would enable the toveya, the plaintiff, the victim, in this case, to receive recovery, that there might be more of an exemption that would be available to the doctors. The doctor figures, based on the combination of these considerations, the doctor would rather just take their chances and have the case brought against them in Besdin rather than brought against the insurance company in civil court. So here's where the principle of arvus comes into play. We know that there's a principle of arvus, that there are guarantors, that a person could guarantee somebody else's obligations. And we have three different types of guarantors, right? There's an arv stam, there's a regular guarantor, which means, what's an arv stam? An arv stam means that first you have to go against the main party, and if the main party, the main debtor, is unable to pay, so then you go after the guarantor. That's an arv stam. Then there's an arv kaplan. What's an arv kaplan? Arv kaplan means that if you are an aggrieved party, you can go either after the person who's chayev, or you can go after the guarantor. You could take your pick which one you're going to go after. Generally speaking, most insurance companies serve as an arv kaplan. You don't have to prove to the insurance company that you've exhausted all of your avenues of collecting from the main person who is liable before you go to the insurance company. No, you can go to the insurance company to collect right away. So most insurance companies, we would assume, are in the category of arv kaplan. And then we have a third category, which is arv shluftutz, right? What's an arv shluftutz? I know, it sounds like a funny term. But what? It means that you can only go after the insurance company. You can only go after the arv. So you might have a certain case where it's understood that when there was some type of an agreement or an arrangement that was made between a party that's liable and the party who would be aggrieved, who would be collecting the party who was liable, that it was understood that there is no right to go after the party, that you only have the right to go after the insurance company. So let's look at it from the perspective of the plaintiff. From the perspective of the plaintiff, if the insurance company is at the very least an arv kaplan, certainly if they're an arv shluftus, but if the very least if they're an arv kaplan, then obviously the aggrieved party, let's say the family that suffered the malpractice, they could choose to go after the insurance company. You have the doctor screaming and yelling, no, I want to go to Besdin, and you can sue me in Besdin. Don't go after my arv, don't go after my guarantor, just go after me, and whatever the Besdin decides, I'm chayev, I'm going to be prepared to pay, but I don't want this after in the court, I don't want you to take my insurance company. The doctor doesn't have the right to do that. The doctor doesn't have the right to say that, because the plaintiff has the right to go after either after the defendant or after the arev of the defendant, if the arev is at the very least an arev kaplan, as long as it's not an arev stam, it's an arev kaplan. So therefore, the plaintiff can say, "I don't want to go after you in Besdin, not an issur akos. I can go after the insurance company because they're a non-Jewish entity in civil court. That's not an issur akos. I want to go after the insurance company." So that's perfectly legitimate. So question: when it's in the other direction. Where if you have a situation where, let's say, the plaintiff says, you know what, I want to go after the doctor. I want to go after the doctor. I know that the Besdin may not necessarily be mechayev the doctor as much as I would be able to collect from the insurance company. But I'm really angry at this doctor, and I want the doctor, I want to drag the doctor into Besdin so that the doctor can be in front of all these rabbis. The doctor can be humiliated and humbled and can be chastised for what a terrible job the doctor did. Maybe I won't make as much money. They won't give me $5 million in punitive damages. That's okay. I can live with that. But I want to go after the doctor. And the doctor says, what do you mean, go after me? I'm covered by insurance. So the plaintiff says, that's nice that you're covered by insurance, but I have the upper hand. I'm the plaintiff. I can go either after the defendant, I can either go after the person who's chayev, or I can go after the arev. It's my choice to decide whether I want to go after the arev. I choose not to go after the arev. I want to go after the doctor directly. So does the plaintiff get to make that call? Well, again, then it depends upon whether the insurance company is an Arv Kavod or whether it's an Arv Shluftot. So generally speaking, I think that we would come to the conclusion that everybody knows nowadays that when you go to a doctor, all the doctors are covered by insurance policies, and this is the way business is done. This is the way of the world, that if there is a grievance against the doctor because the doctor made a mistake, everybody understands. You don't go after the doctor, you go after the doctor's insurance policy. It's almost as if it was agreed upon up front, even though there was never an official contract that was signed along these lines. It's almost as if it was just self-understood that in the event that something would go wrong in terms of the doctor's treatment, that of course the plaintiff, the victim, the aggrieved party, would only be able to go after the insurance company and not go after the doctor. So Mistama, in such a case, even if the plaintiff said, no, I want to go after the doctor, that the doctor would be able to say, you have no right to go after me. I have an Arab Shluftos. This was the deal. We all understood that. You have to go after the Arab. You have to go after the insurance company. So that's the way that we would generally deal with these types of cases. Yes?
So from the doctor's perspective, he has an Arab Kaplan, but from the guarantor, from the damaged party, it's an
Arab Shluftos. That's the machlokis. I mean, we have a machlokis. The doctor saying, treat my insurance company like an Arab Kaplan. So we look at the objective reality. So the objective reality is, this is an Arab Kaplan, it's an Arab Shluftos. I'll give you another example. Another example would be car accidents. So we can have a really scintillating discussion about what the halacha has to say when there's a car accident, right? I mean, that's really the gemara. Where is the daf lamed aleph? You have, you know, somebody's carrying a car, somebody's carrying the chavis, and, you know, suddenly the person who's carrying the car stops suddenly without any warning, and therefore goes into the chavis, which is, you know, right behind them, and it destroys the chavis, and all the wine comes out, and everything gets spoiled. So that's your typical case. The Pesachei Choshen writes about this. That's your typical case. You have two cars that are driving, one without any justification whatsoever comes to a sudden stop and causes the other car to barrel into it, and so there would be damages. That would be only in an analogous case. Talk about, well, maybe it's not an analogous case 100%, because when you drive, you're always supposed to stay a certain number of feet or yards behind the driver in front of you. So if the driver would come to a sudden stop, you wouldn't actually go directly into the driver. So maybe then, whenever that happens, there really couldn't be liability, you know, in the event that the car behind was so close that it wasn't able to stop in time. That's a question mark, because on some level, that's true. On the other hand, there's sort of just the normal way of the road, and if it doesn't look like there's any compelling reason why the car in front would suddenly come to a stop, as long as the car behind wasn't actually tailgating, many cars do, I find when I drive, but they're like really annoying, like road hogs, you know, the people who go like within 2 inches away from your car and the lights are all on, like every conceivable, they have like five different types of lights that are on, you know, so you'll know that they really need you to move immediately. It's just like, you know, the cars have like these personalities. If the person isn't tailgating in that menacing and threatening fashion, so then you really could make an argument that the car that came to a sudden stop would be liable, and that might be even an Adam Hamazik type of situation, because at least it may not be the person's body that's causing the damage, but it's kocho. I mean, on the kocho, if it's the koach of the individual, or even, you know, like the korah and the chavis itself are considered to be an extension of the individual, so a car could be an extension of the individual. I talk about, what if the car already stopped, and only after it stopped, then the other car went into it, so maybe then it only has a chiyubor, and if it only has a chiyubor, so then you'd be liable for if a person were inside the car, suffered physical injury, but you wouldn't be liable for kalim, you wouldn't be liable for the damage that actually occurred to the car at that point in time. They're very fascinating discussions that the Pesachei Choshen goes into about if you would adjudicate all this in Bezdin. I'd love to adjudicate a car accident in Bezdin, but it doesn't come to Bezdin. Why does it not come to Bezdin? It doesn't come to Bezdin because there's an obligation that everybody who drives a car is obligated to be covered by insurance. And therefore, at the end of the day, it's going to be the insurance company, according to their rules and principles and policies, their hisbos, that's going to pay out whatever needs to be paid out, even if it doesn't conform 100% with halacha. Could you say we'll have two different proceedings, that there'll be a proceeding against the driver in Beis Din, and a person will also collect from the insurance company. So the Poskim talk about it, Moshe Sternbach and others talk about it, that theoretically you could double dip, unless that would be in contravention to what the policies allow. The policies say you can't double dip, you can't collect from the mazik and also collect from the insurance company. That would be insurance fraud. So then obviously a Beis Din cannot participate in some type of a criminal proceeding where we would be facilitating insurance fraud. So it doesn't end up coming to Beis Din. The one case where it would come to Beis Din, but I have to tell you I haven't had any such cases, is where there would be, for example, an agreement between the driver that caused the accident and the other driver who was wounded or whose car was damaged by the accident, that they agree that because they don't want their insurance premiums to go up at all, so they agree that they will just take care of the matter between themselves without utilizing the insurance company at all. This happens all the time, actually. This does happen, like a little fender benders type of things, you know, where it's a friend of yours, you're backing up. This happened to me. Just, you know, maybe I remember 10 years ago or so, I was in a shopping center. I was outside of a supermarket, whatever, and I was backing up my car, and there was somebody else who, when I looked out my rearview window, so I didn't see any other car that was backing up, and somebody else who was across the way in the same parking lot looked in his rearview mirror, and he didn't see anybody backing up, and we were both directly across from each other, so we both went out at exactly the same moment, and we both collided with each other. Wasn't major damage. Maybe it was $200, $300 worth of damage for each one of our cars. So we said, you know what? We don't want to make a whole big fuss about this with the insurance companies. We'll just find out how much it costs, and we'll pay each other, or we'll, you know, whoever ended up suffering the greater damage will end up being reimbursed the difference from the other party. And we took care of it in that way. But usually when that happens, the parties just take care of it between themselves. They don't end up going to Beis Din. Why is that? So the post can talk about it. And this is the Pesach Koshin says this as well. He says that in such a case, since there is the theoretical possibility that somebody could collect from an insurance company, let's say that I could collect from your insurance company, but you say that, no, please don't use my insurance company. I don't want my premiums to go. I don't want to lose points. I don't want my premiums to go up. I'll take care of it myself. What you're really doing is you're then serving as the guarantor of your insurance company, in which case you're taking upon yourself not just the obligation that you would be obligated to pay me according to halacha, but you're taking upon yourself whatever the insurance company would have paid. So even if it would come into a Beis Din in such a case as well, would presumably, unless in a very rare case, you had both sides say, no, we just want to do whatever the halacha says, generally speaking, what you'll have is the person who would have been able to collect more money is being asked by the guilty party, no, please don't go after my insurance company, I'll cover it, in which case they really have to cover everything. So the Beis Din, anyway, we just have to determine what would the policy pay, as opposed to what is the Gemara in Perek HaMeniach, and, you know, all of the different Gemaras, what do they have to say? Is this considered to be Nezek Adam Hamuad? Is this considered to be Niske Bor? That just would not be a calculus that the Beis Din would end up making. It's worthwhile to learn the sugyas anyway, and to know what the halakha would be, and it's very fascinating to figure out how it would apply to car accidents, but we just don't end up adjudicating car accidents. There's a very interesting comment that I heard, just a little bit off of the media topic for a moment. I go every single year to a Dayanus conference in Eretz Yisrael, where they bring Dayanim together, mostly Dayanim who serve in the Rabbanut in different towns in Eretz Yisrael, and they invite Dayanim in Chutz La'aretz to participate in the conference. They invite academics, and they invite Israeli governmental dignitaries, and the chief rabbis are always there, and it's always, you know, a lot of fun. Rabbi Schechter is presented at that conference in Amat Torah Mitzvah. Rabbi Willig is presented at the conference. This year, the only two non-Israeli presenters at the conference were myself and Rabbi Bleich, interestingly enough. And the topic this year was Hektel Bedrochim. It was like car accidents, Kukei Atnua, and it was also about what is the responsibility in a halachic system if you're devising laws, Api Halacha, to minimize car accidents and road fatalities and things of that variety. They were talking about some of these issues as well in terms of Nezikin, in terms of Chukei HaTenua. So one principle that we have in Hilchos Nezikin is that Hamashana is Chayev, that if there is a normal way of walking and doing things in your Mishana, you're going to be Chayev. I mean, it's an interesting distinction that you probably covered, this whole idea of Adam Mu'ah the Olam. As the Aruch HaShulchan discusses, Adam Mu'ah the Olam is generally a principle when I have no right to wherever I am at that moment, because I am intruding upon your property. Either I'm in a Rishus HaYachid, your Rishus HaYachid, or I'm going into your property in a way where you have sort of a special space that I'm not allowed to invade, and I'm invading that space. So that's what we say, Adam Mu'ah the Olam. When we're dealing with a place, this is discussed with the Aruch HaShulchan and Siman Shin Ayin Ches, if we're dealing with a place where neither party have the right to go, right? Or what's the more likely scenario when we're dealing with roads, if you happen to be in a street, unless it's a one-way street, usually both cars have the right to be in that street. If it's a one-way street, then you have a situation where one person has the right to be there and the other one doesn't have the right to be there. If you ever driven the wrong way on a one-way street, anybody, that ever happens to anyone, it's like a little bit of a scary, a disconcerting thing. I think it happens usually to everybody at least once in their lives. Like, you make the turn and then you realize, oh no, this is a one-way street, and you gotta go away. Anyway, so if you are on a road where both parties, where both cars are allowed to be on the road, so then we don't automatically say Adam Mu'ah the Olam Bein B'Shogeg Bein M'Mezid and Onis Gomer is Chayev and all of these things. No, we say that if you don't have the intention to, you don't have the kavana in terms of you're barreling into somebody, so usually you are going to be putter. That's why we have these principles. Only a person who is Mishana, the person who stops suddenly, that's the one who's going to be Chayev. It's a different set of rules. It's a different set of rules. If a person is just walking along in the normal fashion and somebody happens to, and they happen to go into somebody else, but they weren't Mishana in the way that they were walking, so then they're not going to be Chayev as a general rule. So what is considered to be Mishana? So a number of the speakers said, well, if I have Chukei HaTenua, I have traffic rules, and somebody doesn't follow the traffic rules. Either they exceed the speed limit, or they don't stop at a stop sign, or they violate something which is a rule of the road, and a rule of the road which is designed in order to promote safety. So once you violate that rule, you automatically become chayav, because you automatically become the mishana. It means there are objective situations where you stop suddenly, which you can derive directly from the Gemara, and then there are the situations of how to be Magdir, a case of Mishana. So whenever you go against the traffic rules, so you're in the situation of Mishana. Yeah.
Is it in general that people usually go a little bit above?
But you do so at your own risk. I mean, if you go above, so then you're taking upon yourself that you're now going to be chayav. If you're going to then be responsible because you don't stop in time, because you don't see something in time, because there's an animal, somebody's pet, or, you know, worse, a child that runs into the road, and because you were going at a certain speed limit, you cause a certain amount of damage, and you were going above the speed limit, so you're going to be chayav for everything at that point. So the very interesting comment that was made, since part of what was being discussed were fatalities, you know, unfortunately, and we know that there are, I think, more people, certainly in Israel, who have been killed through traffic accidents than all of the soldiers that have been killed in all of the different wars, and, you know, that's something that came up a number of times. So one of the speakers, Rabbi Leo Bar Shalom, I think he actually came to YU a couple of months ago. I don't know if anybody saw him, but he gave, I think, a brief shiur. So he's a Dayan in Eretz Yisrael. He's the author of Mishpat HaTsuba, very entertaining speaker also. So he gave an edus that he spoke to Yitzchak Zilberstein. I don't know if there's a relationship or, you know, they just know each other. And he heard from Yitzchak Zilberstein that he heard from his brother-in-law, I guess, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, that Rav Chaim Kanievsky heard from his father, the Stipe Lugon, that's where the chain ends, that they heard from the Stipe Lugon, that the Stipe Lugon commented to him once that he didn't think it was Pashit, that if the European Gedolim, when he was in Europe, because remember, he grew up in a world of horse and buggies, he said that if you would have asked the European Gedolim to Paskin about whether it was mutter altogether to have a system where people would be driving cars and you would have fatalities of thousands and ten thousands of people who would die every single year through the fact that there would be cars on the streets, he thought that it was very likely that the Gedolim would have said it was completely usur. They never would have agreed to it. He said, we've become just inured to the expectation that, oh, you look at a sign, oh, yeah, there have been 2,500 fatalities this year, you know, in this state, in that state, and okay, fine, that's just the price of, you know, doing business. But he said that this is not really consistent with a Torah worldview in which life is the primary value. If you're really going to introduce something that's going to cause so many fatalities, then it's very likely that had a Shaila been asked, the Gedolim was said it's Pashit, that this is usur. If you take a look, there's a tshuva by Rabbi Akiva Eger, which he was approached by somebody who was driving a horse-laden carriage that apparently went into two little children, and it was a very tragic case. This was an accident which claimed the life of the son of the driver, and apparently somebody who was a mishari, somebody who was like a worker, a butler, you know, some individual who was the attendant of the driver as well. And it was an accident. Obviously, he didn't do it on purpose. He wasn't going to kill his attendant and his son on purpose. But something went awry, and the horses somehow didn't go in the right direction, and the carriage brushed against like the side of a wall where they happened to be, and they were both killed. And he approached Rabbi Akiva Eger about what should be an appropriate tshuva. Rabbi Akiva Eger gave him this very extensive regimen of that he has to find an orphan child and provide for the full education of that child until the child is 15 years old, and make sure to have funds to marry off that child when he's ready to get married off, and to ask that child that the first boy that would be born to that individual when he got married should be named after the son who was killed. I forgot whether he said the same thing with respect to the attendant who was killed. And then after he does that with one child that reaches the age of 15, should find another orphan and do it with that orphan until he reaches the age of 15, until the end of his life. He just keep on doing it over and over again. He has to fast every single Monday and Thursday for like a couple of years, and then afterwards not every single Monday and Thursday, but you know, to fast, continue to have a regular fast for the rest of his life. He can go to his own children's chasanas, but he can't go to any chasana of anybody else for the entirety of his life. And you look at that tshuva and you realize just the seriousness of the proposition of what it means to take somebody else's life, even, you know, by accident in the course of a car accident. And, you know, even though obviously we of course would take that seriously as well, but we don't really take seriously just the extent and the enormity of the damage that is caused on the roads on a regular basis in terms of just the cost of human life. So this is just by way of throwing in, even if I can do this, Derech Agav, that it's not really a laughing matter when we speak about like what it means to be Mishan in terms of the Chukei HaTenua. You know, hopefully, for the most part, when people are in accidents, we're not going to be speaking about causing anybody's death, God forbid, or causing any major physical injury. But you have to realize that this is very often a byproduct of what happens when people don't follow the rules. And if you do drive, you should follow the speed limit. You shouldn't go through red lights, and you should never, ever text or look at your cell phone or anything like that when you're driving, because the stakes are just way too huge. It's just like not something you play around with. Okay, that's just an editorial comment. But seriously, I just never, ever do it. It's just, this is like serious stuff. People, lots of people die regularly from car accidents, more than like anything else in the world. Okay, so next. So that's in terms of, you know, the insurance angle. I could go on in terms of different types of cases of Arev, but those are two major categories. You know, when you're dealing with car accidents, you're dealing with medical malpractice, those types of things. Now, there's a second sort of consideration as well, and that second consideration is that often when you're dealing with Adam HaChovel, for example, you're dealing with assault cases are not likely to come to Beis Din for a different reason. Let's say I have Reuven punches Shimon in the head. So I had a case like this. Reuven punched Shimon in the head. Shimon got a concussion. Shimon wanted to take Reuven to a Din Tova because since he had a concussion, he had to miss a lot of work. He wanted to bring a claim for Shevis that he, you know, was obligated to stay out of work for a long time for a Ripoy, right? Rakshi Toyotin, Barapo Yurape, also this week's Parsha, that he wanted to be able to be reimbursed for medical bills and bring Reuven to a Beis Din. And Reuven, in that particular case, refused to come to Beis Din. It was interesting because this was even like well-known personalities. So it was like, it wasn't like some fight in a bar. They were sort of related to each other. I mean, not exactly. What happened was one of them married the ex-wife of the other one. You get the idea. So anyway, they got into, like, you know, a bit of a tiff. And so Reuven, who was the accused assailant, refused to come to Beis Din, and we just issued a seyer against it. It would have been interesting to adjudicate. But why is it that that's the only case I can remember of an assault that came to Beis Din? Why was that the only case of an assault? So one practical explanation is that, generally speaking, an assault is a criminal matter. And criminal matters don't generally come within the province of the Beis Din. It's true, it's a monetary component to the criminal case, but Beis Din nowadays doesn't have criminal jurisdiction. The Dvar Avram writes in the very first tshuva, in the Dvar Avram, Chelek Aleph Simen Aleph, in the Dvar Avram, speaks about the scope of Dina Demalchus Adina, and what are the matters that are within the province of a governmental authority. So he speaks about, obviously, the right to levy taxes, that's within the province of governmental authority, but he also speaks about how the right to provide a criminal justice system and enact laws and regulations to ensure a law and order in a society is also a governmental function. So since imposing law and order is a governmental function, if Beis Din doesn't have those governmental authorities, sometimes throughout history, Beis Din has been given those governmental authorities. That's almost an application. So where does the idea of Beis Din makin ve'onshin shelo min hadin come from? He says fundamentally, that's a governmental authority to be able to impose law and order in society. So if a Beis Din has that responsibility, so then we say, l'migda milsa makin ve'onshin shelo min hadin, Beis Din can decide when they're going to inflict capital punishment, even if there's no Sanhedrin that's sitting in the Lishkas Hagazis, if the occasion calls for it, Beis Din can administer capital punishment, can administer corporal punishment, can give people lashes, can chop off their noses, all kinds of interesting cases. When the Rosh was in Spain, he was given by the government, as the leader of the Jewish community, he was given broad powers of being able to carry out real capital punishment and the like, if it was felt that it was necessary in order to keep order within the Jewish community. So the Rosh sometimes carried this out. He had one case, a woman was unfaithful and chopped off her nose. Interesting cases that you have throughout Jewish history like this. But we, nowadays, I've never chopped off anyone's nose, not because I didn't want to, but because I'm not given that type of governmental authority here in America. We don't have that authority. So therefore, says the Dvar Avram, when Beis Din is not given that authority, this authority is contained within the governmental courts, the criminal courts of a given society, that they have that jurisdiction as opposed to Beis Din. In fact, if you look at your typical criminal case, the case is generally not Reuven versus Shimon in the final analysis. It's the state of New York versus Shimon, because they have an interest in maintaining law and order and ensuring that there not be assaults and other crimes committed in their midst. So therefore, your typical assault case is just going to end up not being a matter of Bezin jurisdiction. If Reuven wants to put Shimon in jail, for example, and to impose criminal penalties, we don't have the ability to do that. So once it has to go to a criminal court anyway, so then usually you can't really bifurcate the monetary aspect of the case from the criminal aspect of the case. They sort of go together, so that's why it wouldn't end up in Bezin. That's why one type of question that I get from time to time is whether Bezin should adjudicate child molestation claims. We know that unfortunately in the community, from time to time, whether it's in schools or camps or other places, there are claims that some authority figure is a pedophile and they're molesting children. And is that something that the Bat Din can handle? Certainly we as a community can't turn our backs to this type of abuse. But what is the role of Bezin to play in this type of case? So I remember I had discussions once with the Aguda community about this. Could we establish a Bezin presence to adjudicate this claim? So I said to this person, this was a person who worked for the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, actually, who came to me, and I said that I think that it's a good idea, but we can't really handle the criminal aspects of the case. That's not in our hands. It's not in our hands. We don't have the authority to decide whether a molestation took place or whether it didn't take place, because that's a criminal determination that has the ramifications of whether a person's going to go to jail or not. We don't have jails. We don't have the ability to put somebody in jail. We can't take over the criminal function. I said if you could bifurcate the criminal aspect of the case from the monetary aspects of the case, if you say, oh, once there is a determination made in criminal court that this person is a child molester, so then the secondary part of the case as to what are the monetary damages and liabilities that the molester is going to have towards the victim and the victim's family going forward in terms of therapy costs, in terms of reimbursements and compensations and things of that sort, if you could bifurcate the two aspects of the case, so then we can handle it in Bezdin. But we certainly can take over the criminal aspect of the case, and often it's just very complicated to bifurcate the monetary aspect of the case from the criminal aspect of the case. So that's another consideration as to why those types of Nezikin cases wouldn't typically be adjudicated in Bezdin either. Although, theoretically speaking, if you did have a finding that somebody was guilty of molestation, then the Bezdin could, at least in theory, take over the monetary aspect of the case to determine how much the molester was obligated to pay for compensation in light of what the molester had perpetrated. Okay, a third consideration is determining Bezdin's jurisdiction when it comes to Nezikin cases in general, and that is a discussion in Gemara Baba Kama, as we know, later on in the Masechta, about Shlichusayu. What are the parameters of Shlichusayu? When we say that a Bezdin adjudicates cases nowadays, does that mean that we adjudicate all cases? So the Gemara says, well, for most types of adjudications, you need the Torah says that you have to go in front of Elohim, you have to go in front of judges that are authorized to decide cases based on a smicha that was received directly from God to Moshe Rabbeinu. Then Moshe Rabbeinu passed on his smicha to other dayanim from generation to generation, right? So we don't have the stature in which we would be described as being in that category of what the Torah describes as these judges who Elohim Mitzav Adas Kel, who stand in the place of Elohim whenever it's mentioned. Sometimes it's Kodesh, sometimes it's Chol. And when it's used in this context, I'm just using it for Kodesh, not referring to any specific pasuk. There are some sukkim where the name is only intended as Chol. But nonetheless, nowadays we don't have a hemshech of that smicha that was originally given to Moshe Rabbeinu. So how is it that we're able to adjudicate cases? What's our authority? So Gemara asked the question about the dayanim who are in Babel. What's their authority? They didn't have smicha in Babel. The dayanim in Eretz Yisrael. So the Gemara said, that's okay. Shlichusayu kavdinan. The dayanim in Babel are the representatives. They're the agents of the dayanim who have smicha in Eretz Yisrael. So Tosfos asked the question, What about nowadays? Nowadays, there are no smuchim in Eretz Yisrael either. Nobody has smicha. So Tosfos in Gittin, Daf Pei Ches Amud Beis, elsewhere as well, says just like you can have a temporal shlichus, just like you can have a geographical shlichus, you can also have a temporal shlichus. There's the geographical shlichus from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, and there's the temporal shlichus that's passed on in time from the Dayanim of yesteryear, the Dayanim of previous generations, to the Dayanim of today. We are considered to be the agents of the original Dayanim who have passed on their jurisdiction to us. But, says the Gemara, when they have transmitted their jurisdiction to us, that's not with respect to all cases, it's only when it's absolutely necessary. What are the cases where it has been transmitted? Anybody know? What are the two conditions that are needed in order to apply Shlichusayo?
Chesron Kiss and Mamon.
Milsa the Shlicha, it has to be something which is relatively common, Yesh B'chisoron Kiss, and where there's a loss of money. So if, for example, you're dealing with a Nezik of a shore that just suddenly decided to gore somebody, we say that's not like a typical thing for a shore to do. If it's not a shore mu'ad, so that's only chatzi nezik. Chatzi nezik is considered to be a knas. It's not considered to be a normal payment of what is a loss of mammon, because really nothing should have been paid, since you couldn't have expected the shore to do this. The notion of an animal harming a human being, we say, is something which is a milsa de lo shlicha, so therefore we don't apply bezin jurisdiction for those types of cases. You look in the first simun in Shulchan Aruch, it says, for example, that if you would have an animal that would gore a human being, that would hurt a human being, that's not a milsa de shlicha, that's not included in bezin jurisdiction nowadays. You have a human being that caused harm to an animal, so that's something which we would expect to happen all the time, right? You know, you're driving a car and you just hit a deer or something, so that is much more shlicha. So it's kind of like funny in the way that it works out. So the dog bites a man, so that's, you know, milsa de lo shlicha. Man bites a dog, that's a milsa de shlicha. But, you know, that's the way that it comes out. So that is not included within Bezdin jurisdiction. And similarly, even a Chabala case, where one person hits another person, say Chabala is also not shliach. So therefore, Bezdin doesn't have automatic jurisdiction. There's a machlokus between the Shach and the Shvus Yaakov in the first Siman of Shulchan Aruch, whether Niske bor ve'esha shliach or not. What's a nisanezik of a boar? Somebody digs a pit or has a pit that they dig in Rishus Rabim. Certainly, if it's even in their property and they allow a person in their property and the person falls into the pit and they hurt themselves, that's nezik boar. The Shach says that that's also something which is, I guess, milsa glo shlicha and not included within shlichusayu. So what do you do with nezikin cases? And the Shus Yaakov disagrees. What do you do in nezikin cases that don't fall within the jurisdiction of Bezdin? I had a very interesting situation where I had a plaintiff in a case where there was a family whose boy was driving a bicycle in a bungalow colony. It was a bungalow colony. I guess it was one person who owned the bungalow colony, but he brought in other people to share it with him during the summer. And it was almost like, I don't know, bungalow colony, camp, let's say a camp. And so one person owned the camp and he maintained the camp, and this person's child was riding his bicycle, and there was a large pothole, and the boy fell into the bicycle went into the pothole, and the boy was injured. So they wanted to bring an action against the owner of the camp. They wanted to bring an action against the owner of the camp, but they wanted to bring it in secular court. The plaintiff wanted to bring the family of the boy who was injured, wanted to bring the case in secular court. Why do they want to bring the case in secular court? Because in secular court, you can get punitive damages. You can get like $5 million. So, of course, you know, why not bring it to secular court? And the owner of the camp said, this was not a case with insurance. He didn't have insurance. Maybe he should have had insurance. But he didn't have insurance. That wasn't, you know, a question in this particular circumstance. He said, take me to Bezdin. He said, it's our cost to go to civil court. You should take me to Bezdin. So the plaintiff had a toin rabbini, a rabbinic advocate. I knew the fellow. He was like, you know, fine Talmud Chacham, but I don't think that he was necessarily experienced as a rabbinic advocate. He was somebody who had a variety of different jobs over the years. This was his latest job, to be a rabbinic advocate, and he was trying to advocate on behalf of this plaintiff who wanted to bring his case to secular court as opposed to Bezdin. And I spoke to him on the phone, and I said, this is an historic case. You're not allowed to bring a case in secular court. You got to bring it to Bezdin. There's no arif here. There's no guarantor. You're just going after the person in civil court. So the Tohen had a very creative argument. So he wrote me a letter, a whole tshuva, and he said, no, because since, according to the opinion of the Shach, the shlichusayu does not apply to niske bor. Here we're talking about a pothole, which is niske bor. So therefore, we're going to say kimli, like the shach of that this is not included within shlichusayu. Once it's not included within shlichusayu, we have the right to go to civil court as opposed to Bezdin, because Bezdin doesn't have jurisdiction. It's just a very interesting question. So here, that happens to be just a mistaken premise. In Simon Chavav, in the Beis Yosef quotes a Sefer HaTrumos. Okay, I'll quote you, I have it here. The Sefer HaTrumos says, Kasavod Bala Trumos, Afilu Dine Chavolos. One example of something not included within Shlichusayu is Dine Chavolos. As I mentioned, Ruim punches Shimon, right? So Afilu Dine Chavolos, She'enem Esrim Lanem Bizman Ezeh, it may not be included within Shlichusayu, just because it's not included within Shlichusayu, that does not create a heter or kos. Also, limso bide goyim doesn't give you the right to go to our coast. It means the Bezdin might not be empowered to decide the case, but then you're just out of luck. That doesn't create a heter or kos. It means that Bezdin can decide that because we think that justice would dictate that it's appropriate for this matter to be adjudicated somewhere, we're going to give a heter for the matter to go to our coast. Bezdin can say that, but that has to be a Bezdin determination. A person can't decide that on their own. Furthermore, the way that it's generally handled is like this. Let me just read this and I'll take your question. Even though it can't be adjudicated, the Bezdin has the right not to, strictly speaking, adjudicate the case, but they can put someone in chayrim. They can say if the Bezdin really feels that the owner of the camp was liable or should have been liable in some way. So they say, well, we can't pask in iske bor per se if we hold like the shach. Maybe the Bezdin will decide that it holds like the shus yakim. We can't adjudicate it. But even if we decided that we couldn't adjudicate it, what we could do is we could say that according to strict halacha, the owner would have to pay $5,000, for example, let's say, for the damage that was suffered. So we can't impose a payment of that amount, but we're going to declare that the owner will be in chayrim until he pays whatever the halakha would dictate that he's supposed to pay. So we're not obligating him to pay, we're just putting him in chayrim. And we're saying in order to remove the chayrim, one easy way for him to do it would be for him to pay this amount. In other words, it just means the Bezdin has to find a different creative way to achieve a just result rather than paskening according to strict din Torah. It can get around to the same conclusion in a more roundabout fashion than doing it directly, but ultimately it does not strip Bezdin from having jurisdiction to determine what is the proper and optimal way to go about adjudicating and handling such a case. So that was another example where people thought that they could get around Bezdin jurisdiction based on the limitations of Shlichusayu. It happens in that case that they made a mistake. And even if something's not included in Shlichusayu, you still have to bring it to Bezdin, and then we just have to figure out how we're going to go about bringing justice, even though we can't decide according to the strict letter of the law in the normal, you know, or in the standard, typical fashion. Yes?
Why did Chavos not fall under Shlichusayu?
Why did Chabalos not fall? Because it's the Milsad Lo Shlicha. No, no, Adam Mu'ad Yolam is just a measure of liability. Adam Mu'ad Yolam means that whenever I cause damage, whether I do it b'shogeg or b'mezid, I'm going to be chayev. But it doesn't mean that every single type of damage that I might inflict is a Milsad Lo Shlicha. Chabalos is where I'm b'kavana going over to somebody and punching them in the face. So we say that's not considered to be something which is a milsa d'shlicha.
It's just by accident
I see what you're saying. You're saying, okay, the chavalos, you're also chayvin if you do it by accident. Okay, so we say that it's generally not something which happens with regularity, even by accident. We don't have people who are barreling into each other with regularity.
But we said by people damaging animals, it was shlicha.
We said that is more shliach. Yeah, because people are generally more careful to stay out of trouble, and animals aren't able to, you know, guard themselves or watch themselves as carefully as human beings, you know, can guard themselves. Yeah, so that's, look, it's in Siman Aleph of Choshen Mishpat that talks about, you know, what is considered to be common and what's not considered to be common. It's a good question. Yeah, okay. So those are, you know, three reasons, I suppose, that some of the classic Nezikin cases don't come so much into the parameters of Beis Din. But nonetheless, what does come on a more frequent basis is what I would call mazik, you know, mamon shel chavero, where there are cases where, for example, you'll have a worker who does a job and the worker causes a lot of damage, does like a really, really bad job and causes a lot of damage. Where you'll have, like, for example, we had a case of a shetel macher who was presented with a shetel and really just completely messed up the shetel. Or you'll have somebody who's a construction contractor. We get a lot of these cases, and they're asked to fix up the home, and they're like the construction contractor from Gehinnom, and somehow they do everything wrong, put in the wrong piping and put in the wrong siding, and don't properly seal the windows, and suddenly there's terrible flooding and there are termites, and the whole house is just a complete disaster area. And the case may start off with being a case of the homeowner not wanting to pay the constructor bills, the construction bills, but it often degenerates into a cross counterclaim by the homeowner saying, not only do we not want to pay, but we want our full damages for, you know, what the person did in terms of ruining our house. So in the case of the shetel, the person said, you ruined my shetel and I want damages. So just an important thing, and I guess I'll end with this, an important thing to note in terms of assessment of the damages. How do you assess damages? Let's say that a nezek does occur. First of all, Adam Mu'ah Li'olam, you know, is that an absolute principle? So you all are familiar with the Machlokas Tosfos and the Ramban, right? The Ramah, just for the record, paskins like Tosfos, that if I have like an onus gomer, where the person caused damage in a way that they really could not have anticipated at all, there's a sturdy ladder, and they're going up a sturdy ladder, and even though it's a sturdy ladder, suddenly it breaks. There's like, I don't know what caused it, like through circumstances that nobody can even fathom or explain. The rung of the ladder lets in, and as a result, they fall on something and break it. So we paskin that there would be no liability in such a case. If we have an onus gomer, so there's not going to be any liability, but that's only like an onus gomer. If it's just an onus, but not an onus gomer, then there is liability. There's liability for garmi if it is, even if it's not something which is directly caused by the person, but the person's actions caused damage that was foreseeable and which happened immediately and was bekavana. So if you have all of those different factors, then we would have an obligation to be garmi. And if it was indirect and certainly unintentional, then that would generally not trigger liability. That's called grumma. So there is a movement by some who say, since nowadays Beis Din paskins cases according to pshara, not according to strict din. So pshara means that we paskin according to what's equitable. Maybe we should be mechayev people for grumma as well. So there is a whole big movement about this, that the shtari beruah in the arbitration agreements to adjudicate cases in Beis Din should say that we're going to exercise jurisdiction to impose liability even for grumma, not only for garmi. So I am not so excited about doing that for a couple of reasons. Number one, the Torah hasn't changed just because Beis Din has a shara jurisdiction. It just means that we look at the totality of the picture, but that doesn't mean that we change the halacha. We might say that even though you're not strictly obligated to pay, it would be proper for the sake of shalom to pay a little bit, but to actually say we're going to be mechayev you for grumma, because grumma is chayev bidei shemayim, like grumma is potter but aser, as we know, that I think is overstepping the bounds of our jurisdiction. Secondly, there's a ksos in Simen Lamed Beis of Katan Aleph that says that when we say that grumma is chayev bidei shemayim, that's not in every single case of grumma. There's some cases of grumma you're not even chayev bidei shemayim. So I can just say that across the board we're going to stop being mechayev in grumma because the person should be chayev bidei shemayim. So I'm not really so comfortable with that. But let's say that something falls into garmi or it falls into adam, you know, mu'ad li'olam, there's an actual nezek. How do you assess it? So it's important to understand that there are two major ways of assessing the damage according to halacha. One is, this is the strict black letter law in the Shulchan Aruch, that you assess what's the difference between what this object was worth yesterday and what it's worth today. If you have like an object, somebody, you know, destroys your slippers or somebody destroys your suit, you don't get the replacement value that you get a new suit. You get what was the suit worth on the market yesterday and what is the before it was damaged and what is the suit worth on the market today after it is damaged. That is, you know, the typical barometer of how you would assess the payment for a nezik. Now, the Shach writes that if it is a type of nezik that can be fixed, let's say that there's just a price that can be paid and you can fix it with the price, so then the amount that has to be paid is what is the amount that would cost in order to fix the item. So the Chazon Ish writes very interestingly that very often if you look at, like, let's say you harm the window of somebody's house, and you're looking at just the value of the totality of the house, there's not going to be any differentiation in value between what the house was worth. You want a person wanted to sell their house on the market before the window was broken and after the window was broken. So does that mean that the person would end up paying nothing? So says the Chazon Ish, that whenever you have a situation like that, you obviously would have to use the second barometer of just what is the price that it would pay to fix the window, as opposed to the original barometer of determining what's the value of the diminution in the value of the house beforehand and what the value is right now. Now, if you look, this is a Chazon Ish I'll recommend to you, and we'll finish with this. This is in Siman Baba Kama, Siman Vav, Sif Katzah, and Gimel. So the Chazon Ish goes a little bit, you know, further. And the Chazon Ish says that sometimes that when you're dealing with an item where you're not able to determine the objective value of how much has been diminished, so he says that you have to look at what the value is worth to the individual themselves. Why do I say that? Because let's say that you have a suit that can't be wasn't worth very much, okay, before it was damaged. Now it was damaged so badly where it really can't be fixed, okay? Or if you would fix it, it would cost more than, you know, the price of a new suit or something like that. So how do you assess, let's say that the suit was 10 months old or is a year old, and the person bought it in the store for $400. How much do you think you would be able to sell a one-year-old suit, okay, that you've been wearing? You enjoy it. You wear it. You get some value on Shabbos out of that suit, right? So it's worth some value to you because of the fact that you get utility out of it. But in the open market, it's probably not going to be worth more than like $2. Or, you know, you'll be lucky if, you know, you give it to Good Samaritan Center and they won't charge you for dropping it off, you know. So, but you're getting some value out of it. So somebody now has harmed it. They spilled some, you know, coffee or some chocolate milk or something on it, and now it's just completely ruined forever. Or they stepped on it and they pulled out some threads, and now it's ruined forever. So what is, so how do you assess the value? It says sometimes it's not a question of how much you can sell it for in the market, but rather what it's worth to this individual. And this is, anybody here going for accounting? Okay, anybody going for an accounting degree? So you'll tell me if this is wrong. But from what I understand from the accountants, this actually has a defined term in terms of accounting practices. This present value, if I would look at present value, which is one way of evaluating for accounting purposes, I could say this is worth $2. So the person basically caused damage of $2, even though the one who owns the suit now has lost this suit that, you know, really came in handy for them. They wore it like half the Shabbosos, you know, in the year. Or, however, there is a secondary accounting valuation system, which is called useful life. Okay, does that sound familiar? Useful life? Good, good, okay. So according to useful life, I just look at basically the entire term of how long I can expect the suit to last. I say if I bought it $500 and it will last me for 3 years, So every single year, it goes down in value $166 according to useful life. So according to that valuation, then the person who caused the damage is not liable to pay $2. They're liable to pay $330, $333 in this scenario where they damage the suit after about 1 year. So if you look at the Chazon Ish, you get the impression that's basically what the Chazon Ish is saying in this type of situation. So certainly when we were dealing with a used shetel that somebody, you know, ruined, so you're not going to be able to sell a used shetel for that much. So therefore, one of the things that a Besdin has to think about as well is if the shetel can't be fixed and you can't pay that value, how do you evaluate how much the person who caused the damage is obligated to pay? Are they obligated to pay what would be the market value or would be the present value? Or do you follow the Chazon Ish and say, no, we're going to follow useful life? So this is just, you know, so to the extent that these types of cases come up in Besdin, so these are some of the cheshbonos, some of the different, you know, considerations that that come into play. Obviously, if a person is a worker, is given the object, we don't always apply Odemua, the Olam, across the board, because they might be viewed more as a shomer in that type of situation. A shomer is potter in an onus situation, so you have to figure out in every single case when is an individual chayef for onus. Onus is like, you know, if I happen to fall on your hat, you know, in the middle of the base manage, unless you put your hat on a chair and there's no reason why I should have expected me in the chair, the other person was guilty of Pshia, so then we say that we don't apply Odamu Adi Olam. Even the Ramban, you know, agrees with that principle. But assuming that there was no Pshia, so then we say Odamu Adi Olam. But otherwise, there are specific situations like a Rishus where both parties have the right to be in, or a person who is entrusted with an object as a shomer for the object, in which case we say that they only have the liabilities of Shomer Chinam or Shomer Sachar, as the case may be. You have to figure out what's the measure of liability and then figure out what is the threshold of Tashlumin. So certainly with respect to cases of Mazik, Mamon, Shel Chavero, that does come up, you know, in Besdin on a semi-regular basis, as well as trying to figure out, there are so many claims, I can't tell you this, I hardly have a din Torah where we don't reject some claims on the grounds of Grumma. So that's because people always want to collect as much as possible. They say, oh, because you did all these terrible things to me, so now my, you know, now my marriage is ruined, or my children don't speak to me anymore, or my, you know, so they always like try to throw in a few Grumma considerations. So generally we don't grant, you know, Grumma claims, but that's also, you know, something which is nechnas l'tzoch ha'cheshbon. But it's just important to recognize in general that whatever you're learning, you know, in terms of the sugyas in the Gemara, it's fascinating, obviously, from a lahagdil Torah l'adira, theoretical perspective, but in terms of the practical world as well, these things do come up, you know, in Besdin. Some come up, you know, more regularly, and some come up less regularly, but it's important to understand all of these parameters so that we can, you know, make sure always to be able to fulfill the mandate of Lasuke Shemaita Saliba Deo. Okay.
What does that mean? What's an arc?
It's pork.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. Look up the Rosh, first Rosh.
Oh, it's this week's part.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all have a
Kimashir test.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we'll snap. We'll bot these in.
Thank you.
I actually have to leave a little earlier because of the weather in Chicago, the canceling of flights, and they said, who knows, maybe I'll end up being here longer than I anticipated. But they canceled my 7:30 flight, so then I was just rebooked on the 6:30 flight.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. Hopefully I'll get off. I won't complain if I spend more time here in Israel, but my wife might not be so happy with that.
Okay. Beautiful. Thank you. Okay.